Okay, so this is Marshall McLuhan's Mosaic, Probing the Literary Origins of Media Studies. What's her name? Elena Lamberti, Bob?
Yeah.
Might have mentioned her a couple times already. But I started reading it on Kindle, and I can grab notes. And Bob at first didn't want me to start off on it because I'm only like 10% into it. But for me, well, Bob and I go over it when he tucks me in bed at night, but also when I can say it on Coach House and then Bob can either expand or correct me, then I learn more. So I'd rather do it as I go along rather than waiting till the end of the book. So what I clip are things that just kind of appeal to me and are of interest. And it's just sort of, I'm not going to, there's no story here. There's just what I'm taking as of interest in the book. So the first thing I clipped was, McLuhan never, something got lost. Seriously. Uh-oh. Bob, did you go up to make the bed? Because I lost, I have to go back to Amazon and download my cloud reader again.
No, I'm here. I'm here.
Yeah, it'll just take me a minute to go back in. So what do you have to say about what I already said?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Carolyn, that's interesting because I was catching up on Bob's Facebook posts. And this is related.
Yes.
He posted about how women appear to be more accurate in their critique of McLuhan's work. And then it was either Bob who posted or somebody else that said, why is no woman reviewed Mosaic?
Mm-hmm.
And here you are.
Well, though, that was, I made a statement earlier this week about the book. I was quite pleased with the book. So I said, I'm saying this is the best book for introducing people to McLuhan. And Bipple, I have a recorded conversation with Bipple out in Winnipeg, Richard Altman, which is coming out in a few weeks. We had to edit a lot of it.
Yeah, they were having too much fun doing it, laughing and screaming.
Yeah, we made fun of you.
Yeah, that's right.
Whoever, not you, Carolyn,
oh.
The you that's listening.
Oh.
And will listen to this. We made fun of all of you. You, capital Y-O-U. And we decided to censor how we made fun of everybody. Because he's a young and up-and-coming whippersnapper. As a matter of fact, I posted a manifesto last night. I should be on March 22nd. Nominating him to lead the charge. So, but early in the week, I announced that this book is really important and should be on everybody's course. And I went to Amazon. There wasn't one review of it. Then I found out she'd got an award, and her name is Elena Lamberti. And the book came out in 2012. It was called Marsha McLuhan's Mosaic. She's an Italian professor at the University of Bologna. And I've met her. She's been on the McLuhan scene since 1998 at the first conference. I found out she was given an award by the Media Ecology Association in 2016, 4 years after the book came out. But I don't see any reviews by anybody of that association. They recognized the book. They gave an award, but where's the commentary on it? Now, it may be embedded in the Media Ecology Association's forum somewhere way back there. But I decided to take Bipple's point. He said, Bob, why? It seems to me that the women are the more interesting writers on McLuhan. So he gave me that pattern. I sort of agreed with him. I hadn't thought of it or said it before. So I started off with his question. And then there's two questions. Why hasn't anybody reviewed her book? And why are women making more interesting McLuhan books? And Then I explained that she's really good at laying out the early McLuhan. And I say there's a later McLuhan that no one deals with, which in my essay on McLuhan. Now, normally I'd have to go, if I posted this, go and find the quotes and post them. But I'm just going to give a few points quoting this stuff. I don't have to acoustically here cite the places. I just say, I know that McLuhan at one point, and I'm not sure if it was in the 50s or early 60s, but I think it's the 50s, he writes to one of his friends and says, I wasted 20 years studying literature. Okay, you know that statement, Carol?
Mm-mm.
Yeah. So I wasted, that'd be early 30s when he went to university, 1929, 30, 31. Left, he was majoring in engineering the first year, but then the next year he dropped engineering, went into English because he started reading books in his summer break and got really into it. So he never stopped for 20 years and read a lot. And then he's saying he wasted his time. So that's a curious statement. And that's right around when he starts doing his media ecology, media analysis, big picture stuff. Another statement is I found when I got the archives from that guy in Ottawa, McLuhan is interviewed in an article in a newspaper or something. He says, I've never been more uncertain than I am now. Here's a guy who goes to Mass every day, and he's saying publicly, I'm uncertain. He didn't say what he was uncertain about, but he was uncertain. So there's many ways to take that statement. Let's see. And then he started doing yoga and things. Those are two statements that are interesting. He is a different person in the late 60s, early 70s. Maybe caused by having the longest brain surgery on himself in 1967. Right. And he kept having problems every few years into the 70s.
Yeah.
Right. And I've noticed that any time a new technology came in, he got sick. Television came in, late 40s, early 50s, he got sick. The late 50s, he got sick. That's when satellites took over. Then the instant replay in the beginning of the Android meme in 67, he got sick again. And then he was sick as cable TV came in the 70s. And then, starts in the late 70s, he can't survive that one. And he goes down. And he can't survive it because he got the D-cell too late. Carolyn gave it to him. He didn't open it. And a week later, he had his stroke. So that's an interesting pattern.
Are you saying that Lamberti, not knowing and not expanding information about beyond the view of him as a literary critic?
Right. She's saying that at the core, because she's a professor of English studies, I don't know, they have different things, culture studies, media studies, but she's an English professor and specializes in North American literature as an Italian. And she's saying at bottom, McLuhan is literature, and that's where media ecology came from. And she objects to the regular media ecologists who have more technical view or sociological view. They don't get the roots in James Joyce, T.S. Eliot, Ezra Pound, Wyndham Lewis, and Yeats, and other philosophers and poets. She thinks that's where McLuhan got his stuff, and that's her world. So she's projecting her career, what she does, her role into McLuhan, and it is totally correct for what I call the early McLuhan. It is not correct for the later McLuhan who saw the devastating effects, and here's another statement. He's talking about the Planet of the Dead in the 70s. People think he's very cynical. He's way beyond cynical. Whatever the postmodernists come up with and their extreme death of the author, death of man, stuff, McLuhan was already there. So,
and she also says McLuhan's roots are in humanism.
Yeah.
And the definition of humanism is an outlook or system of thought attaching prime importance to human rather than divine or supernatural matters, et cetera, et cetera. So, but why isn't she looking at his Catholic stance and him going to psychics, him going into the mystical with Thiel? She doesn't even, well, she doesn't seem to touch on that because she's too focused on the humanism.
Yeah, you cannot categorize McLuhan.
Right.
He's much like me. He's interested in everything, and he explores everything,
right,
including mediums. He does everything, which a real artist scientist does. And we know from Ion that most technologies that were invented were done through the scientist interviewing the medium. The very thing that regular, boring, dumb college professors say, oh, you can't bring in the psychic stuff. We're a respectable university. You know what I mean? They are keeping this split, and that's the Ionic threat. They cannot accept what we're doing with Ion because it violates the whole point of humanism, Carol.
Yep.
Not really interested. It's kind of like an atheism, a cultured, sophisticated atheism, but they believe in helping people and somehow making people more intelligent some way through literacy. Now, McLuhan may be a Catholic humanist. He cites Thomas Aquinas and a lot of Catholic philosophers. But, yes, the pure religion part of McLuhan, and I'm not saying that's the way to be, but the pure McLuhan spiritual part is what academia, the book Gutenberg press victims, can't handle.
I mean, McLuhan was a pro-Burr, so he didn't really worry about people's feelings or how they took what he said. He wasn't into political correctness, so he would be aghast at what's happening these days where people can't even take a little probe without going crazy.
Right. Yeah. So, but I admire what Lamberti has done because she does a really good job as a secular humanist explaining James Joyce, Ezra Pound, and Eliot. Not so much Eliot.
No.
And Lewis.
Well, Maddox Ford, isn't that one of her?
Who? Yeah, Maddox Ford. Who had an obscure influence on McLuhan, maybe, or maybe a serious influence, but McLuhan doesn't write about it. But he was turned on to Ford Maddox Ford by Ezra Pound when he met Pound in June 48 at the St. Elizabeth Insane Asylum, where Pound was imprisoned for treason during World War II.
Jesus.
But what? Why do you say Jesus?
Sorry. There goes another one imprisoned. You know, your quadrants.
Yeah. Yes.
The people in your chart have that tendency to get some attention and get imprisoned.
So what was I saying about it's hard. Most people can't understand Joyce, can't understand the Pound's cantos. They don't find it useful to look at it. Or Lewis. Lewis is even harder. So her intelligence, Lamberti's intelligence, is testified to the fact she can write about these guys, and she has a pretty sophisticated understanding of them and how McLuhan used them. That is really important in the book. That's what I'm looking forward to you reading and learning from. Or maybe you won't learn anything. Maybe you heard it all from me, but or someone else. So
that's
the proviso.
The post was really interesting in what you wrote about it, that comparison of old McLuhan to early McLuhan to later McLuhan. And her post, then she responded,
yes,
which was neat too. And I thought, I wanted you to comment on some of her response. And
okay.
I'm posting it on the chat.
Right. She says, wow, I wake up this morning in Bologna and I'm witnessing a McLuhan Querelle, Q-U-E-R-E-L-L-E. She talks about querelles in her book. I guess it means it's French for quarrel. So she's saying to McLuhan quarrel, I don't see a quarrel happening, but she thought it was a quarrel. And so I answered and said, I disagree, but you can go into her details.
Yeah. Well, and was that? She kind of went into saying, I don't want to get into a fight about whether women are better than men. You know, she kind of took that approach, and I didn't get that from what you were, you know, you were just commenting that women seem to have a better, a more accurate interpretation of McLuhan.
And she says that she has no problem with men, women, or trans. So she's open-minded. And it's McLuhan who explains that we don't get particular, the masses don't get particular about the chemical body anymore because they're in the discarnate state. They're electrified. And then I would say they've got a TV body, a chip body. So morally policing chemical body behavior is quite diminished in the population over the last 30 years. So you have to, in the academia, you have to be careful what you say in any critical way about people's chemical body lifestyles. So
now, that was clearly
that's an example, Carolyn, where McLuhan would not put up with that.
Mm-hmm.
He would disagree or try to make probes to wake the people up who became trans or gay or fanatic heteros. For example, I was talking to a new fan of Carolyn. She was a fundamentalist Christian, and but a unique kind, because she says, "You, if you have a church and a building, then you have to keep your flock going to pay the rent for the building." So she's a Christian, and she hands out pamphlets. That's how she does her ministry. She just goes around in Los Angeles and hands out pamphlets. Will not engage anybody who's got a church. I never heard that idea before, but that's her angle. That's her purity. And she was saying the very opposite of Ion. She said, we must be humble. We must realize we're little people. And went on about that's how you're a Christian. And it was striking to hear that after hearing this, such an opposite thing from Ion for 9 years. I didn't argue with her. I just heard her view. But it reminded me that is a major meme. You have to be humble. You have to realize you've been an egomaniac, an asshole, a secular jerk, and you don't fornicate. Which Carol thinks just having sex with your anybody or your married partner. But I think fornicating means it doesn't refer to sex with your married partner, Carol. I think it means outside of that. But
I'll look it up.
She was quite moralistic about life in Los Angeles.
It's of two people not married to each other.
Right, yeah. So that's what I mean. It's, you have to be not married. So, but what was interesting, she was very intrigued on magnesium and all that. And she wanted to talk to Carolyn and hadn't noticed that when you call Carolyn on the phone, she says she doesn't.
I don't talk to people.
She didn't talk to me. But I saw the L.A. number. I hardly ever answer the phone. But I saw the L.A. number. I said, oh, this might be someone I know. So I picked up, and it was useful to talk to her for over an hour about her L.A. life and her Christianity.
But you notice she hasn't emailed me like she said she was. So
yeah, that's right.
Thank you for scaring her away, Bob.
Yeah. So she had no idea that she was talking to the Second Coming. And I didn't let her on. I just spied on her.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe she spied on me after that. Check this out. Found stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, she picked something up because she quoted Ford, Maddox Ford.
Who is she?
Her quote.
Who's he? There's no he. She's not public. What are you talking about?
Gene, we're not talking about the author right
now.
We're
talking about an L.A. person.
A phone call.
All right,
Gene. Put that stuff down.
I lost that sentence. Put that stuff
stop
down.
Stop doing it, Gene. Put it down and stay focused here.
Okay, so the reason Lamberta gives for writing this book in the first place, which was published in 2006, in a...
No, 2012.
You're kidding.
The book's 2012, yes.
Oh, only 5 years old, 6 years old. So anyway, a student came to our office one day and had this question. Professor, can you please tell me how many pages out of this novel I have to read in order to pass your final exam? So she said she kind of freaked and had hoped that by now her English major students would be more interested in literature than in passing exams. So she went through a bit of an identity crisis, it seemed, and and then decided to write this book.
No, she read McLuhan's. She read McLuhan's. That happened in 2004 or so, right? Doesn't
well,
she
maybe
give a date, 2006?
Maybe
but,
that's what
But
was.
She had, her shock was reading Gutenberg Galaxy in 1996, 2 years before the McLuhan conference, which I'm pretty sure I saw her there speaking 2 years later. But she said she couldn't understand it. And then she, I don't know, read other stuff. She doesn't explain how she came to understand McLuhan. But she does a book on McLuhan 4 years later in 2000. And she feels she understands what she couldn't understand 4 years later to do a book. Now, I don't think you can understand McLuhan that fast. Maybe, but and she is an English professor, so she's widely read. So maybe it was faster. But she was able to give a speech on McLuhan 2 years later. And it'd be interesting to see why she couldn't understand it. What was it? And so I think by the time of that student, she realizes that there's a problem, that the kids are changing, and what's the relevance of her profession, English literature. That was her identity crisis, you know. And she decided that McLuhan provided the answer for a professor of literature.
So that book was...
Probably 6 years in the making, 2006 to 2012.
Okay, I can't find the name of it. Do you know what it is?
What book?
The first book.
It's an Italian one. You just look up her name. Oh, you don't. You have to look up in the index and see it. It's an Italian name. Something
okay.
about McLuhan.
Okay, that's fine. So the first clip that I made is this. McLuhan never approached literature as a subject. He literally applied literature to the observation of his actuality. So right away I got stumped on, what does that mean, what's going on, and let me read it again. McLuhan never approached literature as a subject. He literally applied literature to the observation of his actuality. So
is there a footnote?
There might be. Let me look. I have obscured it with my clip. I don't know if there's a footnote.
Okay, I'll try to find that sentence. That's in the prologue or the...
Prologue.
Prologue.
And it's just page 4.
Oh, okay, you got the same page numbers.
And Bob told me that actuality is just day-to-day reality. That's the word that has been used for just...
Well, McLuhan uses it.
Life.
You don't know what actuality means in general?
Not to McLuhan. Well, in general, I can assume something, but I didn't know what it meant to McLuhan or her.
Yeah.
But it just means life.
Right, and the present. Right. Present existence, the media dynamics. So
he was using literature to observe his life, basically.
Okay, so can you read that sentence again so I can find
it? Yeah. He never approached literature as a subject. He literally applied literature to the actuality. Who's making that scraping noise? To the observation of his actuality.
Can you read a couple other sentences around it?
Well, the next heading is look backward.
Oh, yeah,
progress.
That's the last.
So it's above that by...
Right, but you see the sentence right above the title? We're going to come to that sentence. Now I got to scan up how many sentences above is actual.
20 lines.
The word actuality.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay, so look at 5 lines above that.
Yeah.
It says, it is through his books that he taught me the greatest lesson of my life as a literary scholar. You see that sentence?
Sure.
Quote. And she's quoting him from 1946. And this is where you get the context. He said to his buddy, I think it's Walter Ong, literature is not a subject but a function, and a function is italicized, a function inseparable from communal existence.
Yeah.
Footnote 2. Now, you're not looking up footnotes. So
sometimes I'm able to grab them, and I'm
because
grabbing.
You're on Kindle.
Yeah.
Which makes it harder, but... You missed...
McLuhan's letter to Walter Ong.
Yeah, 1946. So you didn't look this up or focus on this then, because this is her later statement that you're quoting with the word actuality is referring to that.
Right.
So then she says, how could I forget it for so long? So she had forgotten the purpose of her career or her teaching or her university role.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was caught in the university whirlpool, she says, is her answer to the question. Too much aesthetic. That might be the artsy-fartsy world or so. I'm not sure. Too much aesthetic, too much politics. Not much time to stop and look at the whole moving picture. Wrong from the start. So she beats herself for getting thrown by this student.
Mm-hmm.
Then she says, it is time for us, scholars and students in the humanities, to reclaim Marsham Clune and learn from him. He never approached literature as a subject. He literally applied, it's italicized, he literally applied literature to the observation of his actuality.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not what the word actuality means. Okay, it means the present, his realistic environment he's in. But it's how is that different from treating literature as a subject? Why is that treating literature as a function? So what does she mean a function?
A day-to-day action rather than just, as most people would as a subject, just memorize some stuff, not use it as an activity to explore their world.
Right. That might be a way to say it. Yes. Literature is applicable to the issues of your existence.
Yeah.
Especially, she teaches you in the book, the modernists, the men of 1914, their lessons led to breakthroughs for McLuhan, who had the best lessons for our time.
Right. Right. So McLuhan was looking at the world through these writers. It wasn't just literature in general. He chose the writers.
Well, he knew every other kind of literature, too. He read everything.
Yeah. But he emphasized Joyce, Pound,
because
Eliot,
they were
Lewis.
Experimental and dealing with the new communication problem.
Yeah, they were the modernists.
Avant-garde writers.
Right. So that's, and what you do is you explore everything through.
I do exactly what McLuhan did.
Yeah.
But I don't make literature my function.
You explore everything through the lens of McLuhan and then your five bodies.
And the lens of LaRouche. I use different lenses, which McLuhan does too.
Right.
She calls it a mosaic. My picture of the holy offices on the Android meme chart is a mosaic applied exactly the way she defines mosaic. So
right.
I do actually what McLuhan did, because McLuhan, he had time, he had tenure. He would, you know, he didn't have the harassment of a career. He wasn't trying to be somebody politically in the university or something. So he had a lot of leisure time to explore everything, read everything, like me.
The terrible fate of specialists.
Yeah.
They have to specialize in something, but you have the luxury of being able to be what's the definition of a person who looks at the mosaic?
An idiot savant. A generalist, a comprehensivist.
Right.
What is it? Jack of all trades, master of none?
No, master of all. Jack of all trades and master of all.
I'm not master of anything.
I am.
You are. You're a specialist, though.
No, I am not a specialist. I'm a generalist because I look at everything through the lens of magnesium. Now that doesn't make me a specialist. It makes me able to look at everything.
No, people would disagree. That is a specialist view.
No.
Well, you have to understand.
Bert wouldn't agree, but Bert knows.
I think,
no, he doesn't.
I think you're both liaisons.
Oh, yeah. We're whatever you say, Gene. This is between me and Carol. You stay out of this.
He's pointing at me.
I'm pointing at you.
It's you and Carolyn and Bert. Okay, Bert, you're part of the special club. I'm immuning. You and Carolyn and Bert.
What? What'd you say, Gene?
Bert's part of the club tonight, not me, so I'm muting. It's you and Carolyn.
Bert's not part of this.
You just asked for Bert.
No, I didn't.
I did.
What?
I
oh,
did.
Carolyn did. Yeah, well, that's Carolyn. Wrong. I can't even remember what we're fucking talking about.
What are we fighting about?
You distracted me.
I'm a generalist.
You have to understand why other people would see you as not a generalist. You're a fanatic about magnesium. You have to see that. You don't have to agree with it, but you have to see their limited view of you.
Oh, I know.
Right?
Absolutely.
They think you're too focused on it. But you're speaking how magnesium is 700 enzymes, and it's a key part of the body.
Right. It covers everything. So, therefore, by using it as my lens, I'm able to cover everything.
A specialist idea of medicine. You don't include me in your medical world as a doctor of medicine.
Yeah, you're magnesium deficient just like everybody else.
No, I'm not talking about that. She doesn't even understand what I'm saying. I'm talking about my knowledge. Your school and buddies don't recognize that I'm a doctor.
No, they don't.
They don't.
So anyway,
what do you mean? Wait. No, that's the issue. You're a specialist. I'm not a specialist in medicine.
And I move on because I'm a generalist. I don't specialize
in
arguing.
You're frightened. You can't handle a real comprehensive doctor. You think you make fun of me. You run away.
Bob, did I tell you that this little presentation I'm giving to the Rotary next week?
Yeah.
I really developed this whole business about specialists and generalists where in the generation of the baby boomers, they all became specialists. The ones who had professions and had their careers and made their money, they gave up their bodies to the specialty of medicine because they thought, well, I'm a specialist. I'm doing well. I don't have time to take care of my body. I'll give it over to the health specialist. And that was their vast mistake. That was their Achilles heel. Because at the same time that they gave up their bodies, medicine gave up their soul to the drug companies, which made medicine just a drug prescribing cartel.
A military operation.
Yeah.
Not a medicinal operation.
Right. So I think that's where our health really suffered.
You know, I was somehow reading something this week. I took what you just said because I heard you say it earlier and thought that whoever I was reading was trying to get at that people don't realize how specialist they are. And we advocate non-specialism in Iandom, and we show how we are not specialists and we can be applied to anything. And that's why we're a threat to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. We're not specialist enough.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, because people can't attack us if we're being generalists because they think they have to know something to attack you.
Now, here's a really important point. When you say generalist, Barry Nevitt makes this important point in his ABC of Prophecy book, 1980, that you have specialists in literate conceptual world, concepts and ideas. Okay, and the Western artist tries to remind the specialized citizen about percept or their actuality. Don't get too lost in literate concepts. Okay, that's the specialist. And then a smart guy like McLuhan comes along, and he's considered a generalist because he's read all kinds of different schools of concepts. Mm-hmm. So he looks like a guy who, a Renaissance man, because he's covered many conceptual frameworks in the Gutenberg galaxy. But what you have to realize then, McLuhan was teaching this, that he wasn't just a specialist in literate effects or concepts. He was a specialist in cultural percepts, the differences between anthropologically between cultures and psychological differences. So he moved into percept. So many people read a lot about percept, but they're still reading about percept, which can lead to specialism. But they're quite well read, so they can be considered a generalist. I haven't finished the point. That is a limited situation. You're specialist versus generalist. They're both within the Gutenberg galaxy. What Barry Nevitt says, the comprehensive person today is a multi-sensualist or multi-cultural ecology dynamics. They're not a generalist of concepts. They're a generalist of different cultures. And they can go hang out in different parts of the world and be relatively perceptive. See, there's a difference now in being a literate generalist and a experiential, existential generalist, which we call a comprehensivist.
Yeah, or as McLuhan was a prober and an observer, and he tried to apply his observations. So, yeah, so you're saying if someone reads about probing, it doesn't mean as much as someone who does the probing.
Yeah, in different cultures. It's not limited by their literate bias,
right,
or their acoustic bias, whatever they bring to it at the beginning. Because they're, when you're brought up in a culture, you're made biased,
right,
naturally. So I see you tending toward a conceptual meaning
personal.
Of general. No, I'm getting very personal here. And we can, because nobody's listening, Carol. It doesn't matter. They don't understand what we're talking about. So we can get very personal. You're a generalist of the conceptual level in medicine. You know everything about all different medicine modalities, which is getting close to a perceptual multi-sensualist explorer. But because you have to stay in the medical role for years, you're only getting around to reading McLuhan now. You know what I mean? You are almost 70, a little late. But you are naturally what I'm describing, but your career has made you more of a specialist, even in the generalist, compared to the Barry Nevitt meaning. Okay? You get what I'm saying there? Now, I've had time to explore other things because I wasn't a specialist or a generalist in the Gutenberg world. Every one of those holy offices is a different experience. Zappa, LaRouche, especially, and Dr. Beter. And then having been in intelligence, you have to operate that way when you're in a global intelligence network. That's what you're trained to do. That's where neurolinguistics came out of, that ability to look at different cultures and how the individuals looked and used their eyes, right?
Yeah.
It represent different biases. That's a tiny level of it, but that's something that people know about. Are you getting what my critique is here?
Yeah, but can I go on?
Well, what do you think of it? That you're a generalist still in the conceptual world. But anybody else would think you are a generalist of experience because you applied so many modalities in medicine.
Yeah, well, you're talking about your five bodies. I'm just working with maybe a body and a half. So
yeah.
That's your point. So that's...
Well,
that's obvious.
I'm also working with different parts, Bob, realms of the bodies.
I'm working with one and a half bodies, Bob.
Yeah, I work with five, and each one of them has many different aspects.
Yeah. And here's something.
Now, I'm going to ask
Bob.
Jean. Okay, hold it. We have a dial. Now we bring in the others. We unmute them. Jean, Bert, are you guys getting my point, or you're just staying foot in the mouth, stuck with supporting Carolyn? Let me go over and see who's muted.
I can't comment, Bob. I'm
what?
Listening. I'm taking it in, but I'm not absorbing enough to be able to have an intelligent response for you.
Okay, I just unmuted Susanna and Madeline or something. So if they want to say something, you're welcome. But first,
well,
you're there.
I was. Oh.
Yes. Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead, Madeline.
I was disagreeing with you up until you brought in the holy offices, and then I thought about Zappa. I don't know about, to me it seems like you're a generalist conceptualist. You're as much of a specialist as Carolyn is in your own way. The only generalization you've got among the holy offices is Zappa, and even him, you make him really conceptual.
I think that's because you know me through speech, which is
right,
now to be a left hemisphere operation. You don't know my work in intelligence. You don't know what I had to deal with. You don't know the people I killed or the money I stole and all that kind of criminal stuff that we were allowed to do. All right?
Okay, that's fair. That makes sense.
Yeah, nobody knows the realm of exploration I did with my being. And had to deal with all kinds of
questions. Well, if you...
And that's... Yeah, go ahead.
Throw in the evergreens, I suppose, and then you're... The way you engage every random human being that you meet, there's more. But
yeah,
Carolyn
right.
does that, too. I think you guys are same.
Well, no, Madeline, I would agree. There's much similar, but it's interesting that she tends toward the specialist, which is, you know, she's not a specialist compared to everybody else, but she's a specialist right. compared to me. Right?
That's tough. That's a tough one. I don't know.
No, I agree she's pretty comprehensive, but she cannot
be wild.
Are you
saying that because of medicine?
I was banned from her show because I'm too comprehensive on her show. It's a specialist show.
I'm the one that got kicked out of Canada, even though I was already out for 3 years, didn't have a license. But
I was shot, and the bullet went right through me, for fuck's sake. Okay?
Have you ever been in a bar brawl like Carolyn?
Yeah, I did bar brawls. Remember?
Yeah, I remember that. Who was that? That was recently. At Christmas or something?
I started a fight in a bar. I forget.
Yeah, verbal. I'm too clever. I don't get in fights. I've never been in a fight. I know how to maneuver around it and out of it. I let non-physical take over. And we feel sorry for the person who tried to get in the fight with me. Or what happened to them, but I didn't lay a hand on them.
Come on, Bob. Stop wasting time.
Now, we're recording this, and it's going to be sent to Elena Lamberti. She's going to, she sit through all this digression from her book.
Exactly.
Now, I'm a comprehensive of, I would sit through this. I'd be interested in it, wherever it led. I concede it's, we're similar, Madeline, yes, but I also see a great difference, and the psychic told her foster daughter that simple difference. You're influenced by a healer of the body and a healer of the mind, and that's Carolyn and me. That's the difference, and equally important.
Come on, Bob. Let me continue. So the next page.
Okay, dysfunction. Okay, back to the quote.
Oh, geez.
Literature is not a subject but a function. It seems to me that literature is part of your media diet, your actuality. You're not allowing yourself to be a specialist and treat literature as a subject. And McLuhan's career went that way. I met many students of McLuhan who complained that they couldn't get a handle on what he was talking about so they could figure out a topic for their master's paper or for whatever career they were trying to get to. They couldn't apply it because they were not going to be him, so he was going to be a subplot that they'd add to themselves. They didn't know that they would have to act like him and be interested in everything to be successful in their career. You know what I mean? They didn't understand that he was advising them on how to live, not teaching them literature.
Right, there's background noise for someone who needs
who's
to
in
mute.
The public there needs to mute it.
So one thing that Lamberti...
So you get that, eh? It's
if,
a function.
Yes, we got it.
No, but okay, now we go to your sentence. You
I'd
say,
like to.
You, her sentence is, he literally applied literature to the observation of his actuality. In some ways, there was an old term in university for a fossil.
Yeah.
That was a guy or a woman who never graduated, stayed and went to courses for years, ended up being in college for 10 years, dabbling in courses. They never got out and grew up and got into the workaday world, supposedly. McLuhan, Scott Taylor told me, it was just a fossil, a guy who stayed in university and kept reading and going into all the departments and never graduated to reality. And so he was always arguing and being like a young student with everybody constantly and showing up in every department. There's that kind of application of himself that was not realistic.
Well, that's me again, because I apply magnesium to every department.
yeah, true. And I apply you to every department.
Okay, so we got that sentence. If we'll move on to the
next. Why did you not understand? It's good to get it clear.
No, Bob, I understand. I'm just bringing
yeah,
it out.
Yeah, now you have to tell us what you didn't understand. That's how we learn.
I told you in the very first moments of this sentence.
No, I'm not. Well, you tell me again.
Reality, not using literature just as a subject to memorize, but to use it as a way of seeing the world.
What he was doing, as a professor, Carolyn, to his students, he wasn't teaching them. He was talking his problem. He was neurotic, who every day discussed, what are we going to do? The electric world's changing. We can't even have books. Hey, come on, mute yourself, Madeline, okay? Who's the one with the stupid background going on and moving things? So you understand he's a neurotic talking about his fucking magnesium deficiency day in and day out and making that the course content.
That's right. That's very
you get
good.
That, Bert? It's rather crazy, right? Rather neurotic.
No, ask Jean
yes.
if she got it so she doesn't get neurotic.
Yes, I got that.
Good.
And he was very clever to disguise it because he was a neurotic who used very complex information to express his neurosis. He was communicating about books he read and say, what is this? And talking about it. And people thought, oh, I'm supposed to teach this. And average specialist-oriented students would find it unfathomable, and they'd quit because they didn't learn anything from him.
And this is why I like the book, because right at the beginning she lays that out and becomes obvious what McLuhan was
yeah.
trying to do, whereas I don't know if I really got that before as easily.
She helped you understand what McLuhan was doing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm taking a little further and saying he was a neurosis. Are you getting my cartooning of what he was doing?
Yes, Bob.
Okay. Look at that condescending specialist tone we just heard. You never get that tone from me.
So then, this is another sentence I like. She quotes...
What page?
6.
Okay.
She quotes a Canadian poet, and the poet says, the time for the ordinary is not possible anymore. I love that sentence.
Because you know you live it.
Right.
You identify with it.
Right.
You see, you're applying it to
yes.
yourself. You're going user is the content.
And
you only identify with something that strikes you as relevant to you. Try identifying with something that has nothing to do with you. Actually, it's bad advice for you.
So she's saying that that's what drove her and drove McLuhan.
That's a good word, drive.
Drive them. Because they don't want to be ordinary people. I don't think anybody wants to be ordinary, and people choose very bizarre ways of not being ordinary, but
yeah.
I know for sure that we're not ordinary, and what we're doing is not ordinary.
Well, here's what's interesting. Who is the poet she quotes?
Risha Dunlop.
Not Risha.
Rishma.
Carolyn Reed is... glosses over things often.
Not generalize in my world.
I will. That's true. You know that you say sentences wrong from books when I'm listening. Rishma Dunlop. She was, I think, the wife or partner, I don't know how married they were, of David Sobelman. David Sobelman was the playwright or screenwriter or script maker of the documentary McLuhan's Wake in 2003, 2004, and 2005, in that period. So he's a cultured person that people know in Toronto. He was a big influence on the author, Lamberti. He was a mentor to her. In the acknowledgments, which I haven't read, it's the only part of the book I haven't read yet, she names a lot of people. I wonder if what she says about David. But David told me that he was the hired by the University of Bologna to be her story editor, to make her book have a story, I guess. And let's see, if you look up his name, Sobelman. 112, no, they don't have an acknowledgement, or, you know, a Roman numeral page number. But we need to look here to see if she gives special mention to him. The point is that she's citing his partner. And so they're probably really good friends. And this poet got ill, Rishma Dunlop. She got ill and died a few years ago.
2016, I just looked her up.
Looked her up, yeah. She was a Canadian Indian, that's Asian Indian. So she died just a few years ago, and I was in talks with David Sobelman in that period. That's when he took an interest in what I was doing. So, and he probably told me about his work with Lamberti because we probably talked about the book. So the time for the ordinary is not possible anymore. That is someone making an idea of being not ordinary. From Ion's point of view, to die today is ordinary. To not die is not being ordinary. Okay? So we advocate a means to be extraordinary and not die.
Mm-hmm.
So I find this an example. I don't know her, and I'm trying to be mean. I'm just saying this statement is an abstraction because she transitioned from our high standards that we apply. Now, Carolyn, she's not ordinary because she raises people from the dead. And we're not talking as a cult here. We're talking whatever is not a cult, which is very hard to prove because we obviously sound like a cult, right? There's no way we're not sound like a cult right now. But we're trying to say, no, we're not a cult. And maybe some of the people here would agree with that. But this is an example of Lamberti quoting a concept, an ideal, and she's being reviewed by somebody now who is actually extraordinary. That's me. It has to put up with a semi 1.5 version of extraordinary, known as Dr. Carolyn Dean, a specialist in being extraordinary. So when I'm reading these books, Carolyn can read anything, and it applies to her because she did it. When they worry about FEMA and national concentration camps, Carolyn's already been put in one, or was put in one, already had her license taken away. And yet she's not a... like, I don't know, Daniel Berrigan or something. She can remain low profile while going through everything. So that's pretty extraordinary. So
moving on?
Yeah, moving on.
And just the next paragraph, just to flesh that out for McLuhan, Lamberti says, "The way I see it, retrieving the structural can reveal what is perhaps McLuhan's greatest legacy, a different forma mentis." So that, like a mental form. I didn't look that up. Maybe I should.
I looked it up, Carolyn. You can look it up. It just means a mental attitude.
Yeah.
So where is that? Page 7?
Just below the words by Rishma. Page
just below.
6.
Oh, yeah, the first sentence. The way I see it, retrieving the structural can reveal what is perhaps McLuhan's greatest legacy, a different form of mentis, a different mental way of looking at things. Are you looking it up? You just type it in and it'll come up.
No, I believe you.
No, you have to look up and get the exact words.
I don't think you would lie to me at this
stage. I know.
Stage.
I'm interested in the exact words. You're faster than me getting the thing brought up.
Yeah, you think.
So she says, this is a new frame of mind conducive to a different approach to knowledge. Now, we live this. We, you guys know, we are doing what she's praising McLuhan for doing. We do it, as Ion says, way beyond McLuhan.
Yeah,
he's a specialist compared to me.
Let's talk about the book, Bob.
I am. This is how I react to this. I cannot read a book with saying, well, this is fucking silly compared to me.
Form of mind. What? Form of mind. Form is forma mentis, form of mind. So,
well, what's that mean? There should be some
a
more
way
words.
Of thinking, a mindset, or set of attitudes.
Right, so it has a simple meaning.
Yeah.
A different attitude, a different intellectual approach.
So continuing, this is a new frame of mind conducive to a different approach to knowledge, wherein knowledge can be perceived as a continuum to be investigated in all its complexity. A very serious approach, which nevertheless is also extremely playful. So I like the fact that she put that in there. And then she said, McLuhan was at first a professor of English who based his investigations of the media upon a literary paradigm, namely the one provided by Edgar Allan Poe in his famous short story, A Descent into the Maelstrom. That simple story teaches us to look at the final effect and work it backward until we find the original cause. So that's, she's setting it up that she's trying to say that that's where McLuhan got his, based his investigations upon a literary paradigm. Now, there's a lot more. Bob would probably say he had dozens of influences. It wasn't just Edgar Allan Poe's.
But Poe provided the appropriate metaphor with the descent into the maelstrom,
right,
where the sailor realizes in the whirlpool that the ship is going down in that some barrels and different objects that have fallen into the whirlpool are sucked down, but some pop back up. So his brother straps himself to the masthead and looks for security there, but he's doomed because the ship's going to go down and suck him down. But the writer says, I didn't strap myself to the masthead. I grabbed a barrel that I noticed would be sucked down, but then pop back up.
Yeah.
So that's your retrieval aspect of McLuhan's tetrad. You get extended into a whirlpool, and then you get retrieved, and you pop out of it. It's actually a description of a tetradic action in the whirlpool.
It's a description of a MacGyver approach.
Yeah.
You look at the whole picture, and you
come up with a little solution.
You're always looking for solutions.
Well, Cosme Werner said that intelligence is the ability to take what's in your immediate environment and use it to your advantage.
Yeah.
MacGyver, the TV character, would be in a certain difficult situation, and he could look at some scotch tape or something else and mm-hmm. figure out how to apply it to his situation.
Mm-hmm.
And you are like that in medicine.
I'm like that in everything.
Yeah, 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 that's true. In when you make things.
Yeah.
Yeah, you... it always turns out very good. You solve the issue,
yeah,
no matter how much limited your resources are.
Right.
I'm not like that at all. I can't do nothing. I don't get involved in problems.
Oh, right, that's right. You don't see a problem.
Yeah, and you'll hear Ion talk about that tonight and the Ion thing. All what we're saying is relevant. I keep thinking, oh, yeah, this is what Ion talks about. So you'll notice when you hear the Ion that we play tonight, it applies to what we're saying here. Carolyn sees problems all over the place. I don't.
Right. Very good.
So I'm useless at solving problems because I don't recognize them.
All right. Wow.
You got that, people? Are you impressed?
No, I think they're scared. They're even more scared.
They're even more scared now.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't want to be my traveling companion. I'm of no help.
No, that's why I like traveling by myself. Oh, I'll meet you in
New York,
Tunisia, Bob.
Yeah, you'll get there on your own.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But I always remember Abby Hoffman and Tim Leary. All these guys came to Toronto in about 1986 and had a big panel of these 60s guys, Eldridge Cleaver. It was a very interesting panel. And after, I'm over in the corner talking to a fucking retired alt-right guy, which they call, that's what they would call him today. He read Spotlight newspaper. He was the only guy next to me who read the far-right anti-Semitic Spotlight newspaper. And I went over talking to this nerd, ultimate ugly nerd guy, and very involved in talking. And Ian Arlett, my bodyguard, comes over and says, Bob, you're missing Abby Hoffman. Everybody's talking to Abby. It's really good. Come over. Stop talking to this idiot. I don't think he said that, those words, but he meant that. And he dragged me over, but it was over. Abby had left. But that's a perfect example of what Bert's saying, or Gene said. Whoever I bump into on the street, I engage with, whether they're famous or not.
Yeah.
And I missed Abby Hoffman on that point because I talked to this guy.
And probably saved him from dying 18 months later.
Right. And this is a problem on the airplane. I get talking to people beside me. Carolyn can't stand it. She wants to sleep. She doesn't want to talk to some jerk. But I'm talking to them and turn him into my best friend within 2 hours on a long flight.
Yeah, so. And you know how he ends conversations with all these people. Well, you should talk to my wife. She can cure you. Here's her number. Call her up. She'll fix you up.
And I get rid of them. I hand them over to Carolyn.
And then that's why I have to leave a message. Do not leave your number. I will not return your call. Ever.
You're just another dupe of Bob. I know Bob sent you. That's not our message.
Yeah, Bob set you up. Okay. So the next thing I clipped was...
Well, did we finish that?
Sure.
Okay, Edgar Allan Poe. So the technique of the suspended judgment and figuring out the pattern and how to exploit it, like a MacGyver, is the main metaphor for McLuhan in surviving in the 20th century.
Yeah.
You've got to figure out what's retrieved. I think he thought Catholicism is something that never dies. He actually said that. The Catholic Church, like the solar system, will never go away. He said it may only end up having two members. And he says, Jesus said if there's only two members, one of them, or maybe St. Peter said this, one of them's got to be Pope. So,
and one of them's got to be a spy.
Well, a bodyguard for the Pope. A spy bodyguard, yeah. So the that's pretty extreme to say the Catholic Church would never change, would never disappear. But he also says most media don't disappear unless we are in a new situation. But
well,
I don't know if he'd say that in the 70s. He would for the public.
But they all stay on a certain level, even if it's a nostalgic level. We'll never get rid of anything.
Right.
Okay.
I'm pretending to agree.
Yeah.
So the descent in the maelstrom is a key archetypal launching pad for McLuhan. He applies it in all his books all the time.
Yeah.
But it does not serve the later McLuhan. That's what I'm saying.
Okay, next
And
clip.
She won't get that part.
Fine, Bob.
She'll keep saying this Poe thing is very important.
She's got to maintain a certain focus, even though she's trying to be discontinuous. Writing a book means she has to maintain her...
You know what she's doing? She's an agent for the book medium itself.
Yeah.
She's an agent for the afterimage of the Gutenberg experience. In the end, she's celebrating book, which
yeah.
Early McLuhan was doing too. He found a way to make books relevant. They had to absorb the present and be unreadable, like Finney's Wake, but they were preserving the book, and they got people reading for a few minutes.
Right.
She is wrecking. That's the function part. It's an important
right.
part of your media diet, and you've got to come up with a way to make books relevant again to people.
Yeah.
So she's
Good.
Dedicated to that thing. The later McLuhan, not so much.
Okay. Next clip, Lamberti says, just below that, this book will challenge previous binary perspectives on McLuhan, bracket, as a critic, you were supposed to be either for or against him, bracket. So that, I mean, that's just the obvious thing, that when he got pulled into the pop culture world, he lost his academic status in a way, and then
yeah.
people could rip him because he was... a pop star.
This book will challenge previous binary perspectives on McLuhan, you know, pro and con.
Yeah.
As a critic, you were supposed to be either for or against him. And she does this by attempting to suspend biases and judgments of the validity of his hero, of his theories on media. Attempting to suspend biases and judgments of the validity of his theories on media. She's going to say a little later, it's not what he said, but how he said it.
Mm.
Is what's important. And if you look at a paperback copy of Understanding Media, it says on the back, the important point of this book is not what we say, but how we say it, what media you use. So she's applying the McLuhan method to McLuhan, emphasizing
mm-hmm.
not the what he said, whether it's right or wrong, but how. What's the how? What's the method? What's the communication savoir faire he's doing? That's how she bypasses the dialectical arguments.
Okay. As soon as you adjust to McLuhan's literary landscape, you will start to look at things in a different way.
Now, where's that?
Page 7, toward the end. As soon as you adjust to McLuhan's literary landscape, you will start to look at things in a different way. You will see them as they truly are and learn how to see through them. So it's the whole lens business of literature, and that's just some words. I don't need any explanation on that.
Yeah, but I want to go into it.
It's the very last paragraph.
Yeah, I got it.
Yeah.
She says,
as soon as you
read Play with them. Play with McLuhan's patterns. Play with them. Trust the image of McLuhan I want to show you. Listen to him. Read his books. He is a great storyteller. Have confidence in him even when he drives you crazy and forces you along detours, when you want to rush and he forces you to slow down. Take a step back. Stop and look. Not with your eyes, but through all your senses. As soon as you adjust to McLuhan's literary landscape, you will start to look at things in a different way. You will see them as they truly are and learn how to see through them. You will see the grammarian through the guru, literature through technology, and the humanities through media. You will see through the literary origins of McLuhan's media studies, and from there you will set off on a new explorations of your own.
See, you will, Bob, you can't read.
Just a minute. You will learn. Well, I noticed I made a correction. You don't notice that you made a mistake. Yeah.
Oh,
you will learn
deeper. The night
yeah, I go
goes
real deep.
Deeper.
Yeah. You will learn to apply McLuhan, Carolyn, and understand why literature is not a subject but a function inseparable from our communal existence.
Function.
Now that
function.
That is
function.
A literate. That's a book person, a visually biased person, or book prejudiced toward books, trying to get more grants from the government or from the public to support your medium or what I call your mythic stage. This is the technology she's fanatically dedicated to. Damn literature. And we know from Ion and Causing Awareness, get the hell out of bookland.
And this is Bob's unbiased approach.
It's my unbiased approach. Ion says there's only two books worth reading, The Bible and Phineas Wake. And that is the beginning and the end of the Gutenberg continuum. Begins with the Bible, Northrop Frye's The Great Code, McLuhan's so-called competitor at the University of Toronto. He wrote a book on the Bible as the great code to culture in the West. And it ends with the cancellation of culture in Finnegan's Wake.
Okay. So then chapter one, the first section, From Figure to Ground. This was an interesting quote.
Okay, well, let me say what you're... This chapter one, we just finished the prologue. Chapter one is a renewed approach to Marshall McLuhan's poetics. So she's going to restate what she already said in the prologue, right? She's going to try to make the same point again.
Yeah, so you tell them, then you tell them what you told them, and then you tell them what you're going to tell them again or something like that.
Yeah, and then you tell them again, and then you told them.
Yeah. So she quotes anthropologist Ted Carpenter, McLuhan's lifelong friend and colleague, who wrote that quote, knowledge.